Please be seated.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. We had a little bit of a delay.
Oh, we had a huge delay. And I'm totally responsible for it. So sorry about that. My plane from Reno had mechanical problems. I thought they were working on the wing. And then when we get on the plane, they said it was an armrest. If you can believe that. So nice flight to Las Vegas, my favorite city to visit, second home. Of course, coming in here, what happens? The wind hits and the plane's like that. So I didn't know if this was meant to be today. But and then there's traffic on the freeway with the construction between Sahara and Charleston.
So we're very sorry about the inconvenience, but I'm sure you guys, you know, we could have done it without him and then we could have played the tape. But I thought he wasn't that far away. So again, we're very sorry for the inconvenience, but since he was so close, we wanted to wait for him to get here. All right, so thank you. What I'm going to do is I'll have both of you, when you get up to speak, if you wouldn't mind, please say your name and spell it for our clerk for the record, and I'll ask the appellant. I do acknowledge, and I have told the clerk that we have an amicus here as well in the sitting in the audience, and maybe you could say her name for the record. And do you want rebuttal time?
I do.
Okay, how long?
3 minutes.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you. You can proceed whenever you would like.
Please, court. My name is Adam Gans, A-D-A-M-G-A-N-Z. I represent the plaintiff in the underlying matter, the appellant in this matter, Ms. Glover Armand. And as I said, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of rebuttal time. Your Honors, justice requires that the district court's granting of summary judgment dismissing appellant's case in its entirety be reversed and remanded for trial for three specific reasons. First, the district court failed to adhere to any standards that have been well established by our legislature and the Nevada Supreme Court with regards to motions for reconsideration and was therefore just a re-arguing of its originally denied motion. The second reason is there was genuine issues of material fact as to whether or not Officer Cargill used due care and if he violated NRS 44B.1.700 and acted contrary to his own agency's policies. And third, because of these issues of disputed fact, Officer Cargill should not have been granted discretionary immunity because his actions failed to satisfy the second prong of the Nevada Supreme Court test outlined in the Martinez case. More specifically, the evidence viewed in light most favorable to plaintiff and the appellant showed that while Officer Cargill's decision to enter the blind intersection without using due care, he failed to comply not only with the state law regarding emergency vehicles entering the intersection on a red light, but he also failed to follow policies and the objectives of the city. Therefore, his actions were contrary to policy, not in furtherance of it.
Are you familiar with the new Clark County School District versus Payo case Justice Hardison just wrote, 2017?
I am not.
Okay. Well, on at least one of the causes of action on negligent supervision and hiring, the Supreme Court just came down with a decision on that particular cause of action on saying that discretionary immunity would apply in those situations. And that was a case where it was a middle school, a young lady who's playing hockey there. They put hockey on the curriculum. And in any event, the hockey puck went into her eye. And there were multiple causes of action, just like in this case. We can ask the same thing of the respondent.
So
that just came down like a month ago.
Your Honor, this is a very specific, finite set of facts in this particular case that the legislature had already enacted a statute that specifically said he had the ability to be able to go through an intersection on a red light in a certain manner. He had to use due care in doing that, and when he failed to do that, and because there are questions of fact, you have to assume that in the light most favorable to my client, that he failed to do that. If he failed to do that, then specifically, cases such as the Franchise Tax Board case just recently came down in 2014, just specifically said that, and is essentially the theme that's come down from Martinez, which is if you're not following policy, then you're not entitled to immunity. And the theme of the cases that came down after Martinez, including Butler, Martinez, and the Franchise Tax Board, specifically said that if a statute or regulation or policy requires the government employee to follow a specific course of action, and he fails to do so, and he fails to do it in that manner, then he's not entitled to immunity.
So you're saying at least on that one cause of action as to failure to follow policy using red lights and siren?
Yes.
At least to that cause of action. Immunity doesn't apply.
Yes. And I can also tell you, as far as the negligent hiring, training, and supervision issues, that was not much of an issue at the district court level. I'm not even sure that it was other than, might not even be mentioned in the appellate responding briefs, other than the fact that if he doesn't have discretionary immunity to go through the intersection, or if he does have discretionary immunity, that the negligent hiring, training, and supervision claims also fail.
Let me ask you a larger question, which actually may change the entire paradigm of your argument.
Sure.
Martinez is an interesting case. It's a Med-Mal case, right? So yes. What Martinez does, it adopts the federal FTCA test that would have applied to Med-Mal cases, yes. Right? What's interesting, if you trace back to those federal cases, right, that test that applies, that Martinez adopted in the federal system, doesn't apply to law enforcement activities. Now, Martinez didn't adopt the test that would apply to law enforcement activities. Why would it? It's not a law enforcement case. So why is this even the right test? Why are we even in the right paradigm talking about discretionary function immunity as opposed to, in the federal system, it's called the private analog, the private analog exception, which applies to military and law enforcement activities. Why isn't that the test?
Well, I don't believe that there's any case out there that says that this type of test does not apply to government agencies and law enforcement.
Here's the language from Martinez. This is the language. It's the Nevada's waiver of sovereign immunity is, quote, to compensate victims of government negligence in circumstances like those in which victims of private negligence would be compensated. Now, the test lies in those words, like those, right? Because law enforcement does things that are totally unlike those that private actors do. Private actors can't speed through intersections. Private actors can't do no-knock search warrants and kick down your door. Private actors can't, conduct spot raids. So certain law enforcement activities are not like those that private actors can do. That's where, at least arguably, that's my question, arguably where the test comes in through that sentence.
You nailed it on the head. 41.032 came out in 1965. 4 years later, 44B700 specifically gave guidance to, so after they already said that you have immunity for doing certain things, 4 years later, the legislature says you have immunity to do certain things like running through a red light, but you have to do it with due care. If you don't, you are still liable for those consequences. That's what's different between this jurisdiction and all the jurisdictional cases he's talking about and everything else that would relate to police officers, because it specifically says that if emergency vehicles are going to take the effort to run through a red light, they have to do it with due care. And if they don't follow their own directives in doing it with due care, then they're not entitled to immunity. And that's specifically why this is different. And the theme is very obvious after Martinez. Like I said, not only in Butler, but also in the Boulder City case, there was language in there from the court that said, the court also noted, even though they granted immunity in that case, in the Boulder City case, it said the court also noted that there was no evidence that the employee failed to follow the established procedures. Again, another case saying, look, if you set up guidelines, you want to follow procedures, we're going to go ahead and give you immunity to do that. Similar to the case of Marudi, where they said you can handcuff a person in the front and the back. If it had handcuffed them through his leg or some other way, they would have probably not given him immunity because he wasn't following the policies and procedures.
Well, don't you think that in all of these cases that the appellate courts have gone great lengths to parse out each cause of action and see whether or not discretionary immunity applies or immunity at all? And here, the district court gave a two-sentence, I grant summary judgment.
And I would agree with you. The issue was not much of an issue in the district court level. It was bootstrapped to the rest of the arguments to say, well, if you're going to have immunity for this other stuff, you're also going to have immunity to the other things. I would think that would be something that, again, the question is whether or not we're going to go back up and forth. I'm not familiar with the newest case, and I do apologize for that.
That's okay. It only has to do with one of your causes of action, and that is only for, the way I looked at your complaint, you had four. You had the failure to follow policy of using red lights and siren. You had a failure to use due care. You had a negligent supervision, and then you had negligent entrustment, which the district court didn't talk about each one separately. And what test would apply to each one?
And all I can say is that those weren't even the arguments that were made at the district court level. So I would argue that those things have not been brought before you, and that's not what was ultimately decided. But again, the issue, even on reconsideration, that was not even addressed other than basically to bootstrap it, like I said, to say, for instance, the cost issue, they were awarded costs. We're not really talking much about whether or not those costs, because obviously if we prevail and it gets sent back down, then the cost issue is not an issue. That was the same argument with regards to the negligent hiring, training, and supervision. If it's going to fail on this argument, it's going to fail on those other ones as well. So, and my point is there has not been any law guiding us to say that this should not apply to these circumstances. And I do believe that 484B700 specifically cuts out an area that says they are liable. And I believe that the legislature had the opportunity to make that determination back then. And as your honors are well aware, this is a case where there is a significant number of questions of fact that remain. It's certainly, essentially, at the district court level, counsel actually conceded that there are disputed issues of fact, but he said they were not material issues of fact. And unfortunately, they are material issues of fact, because if he failed to comply with his own policies and that particular statute, then he's not entitled to the immunity. Just like the Franchise Tax Board case said, there's another case too, the ARA case, ARA Leisure Services, it's a Ninth Circuit case that said, where the choice is a failure or refusal to follow safety standards, there is no immunity. And it's the same thing that happened in Martinez. It was a state actor who fell below the applicable medical malpractice standard of care. He didn't comply with the standards, and therefore, he wasn't entitled to immunity. It's the same thing that happened in the Butler case that we talked about. And Butler was a case where a spastic quadriplegic was paroled. He was sent home, and they put him in a situation where he was unsafe. And they said that was not discretionary and furtherance of the policy to put him in a house where he's not going to be taken care of. So each of those situations goes towards the falling below, and you have to get to the questions of fact. The questions of fact in this case very clearly are in dispute. Whether or not he used due care to cross the line and hit my client's vehicle. His car hit her vehicle. There's no dispute that he was in her lane as she's traveling through a green light. And the facts are still in dispute as to whether or not he did that safely. And that's the issue that needs to be in front of a jury to make a determination. Because if he failed to comply with 484-700, then he's not entitled to immunity. And then I would go back to the motion to reconsider. If you look at the actual motion to reconsider, as your honors are well aware, motions to reconsider are not a venue just to re-argue and rehash motions that people have lost. You've all sat as trial judges, and can you imagine if your order here today said it was okay for them to go ahead and reconsider this with no new law, no new evidence, and nothing more than just rehashing of the same old arguments again, and we're going to send that back down and say that's okay, and you can only imagine that the tidal wave of motions to reconsider that will then follow from that particular time. I'm going to go ahead and...
Yeah, you have 3 minutes, and we'll stop it right now, if that's right. Good, because you have 3 minutes and 15 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, we'll hear from respondent.
Good afternoon. I'm Chris Kraft, here at the City of North Las Vegas, and Sergeant John Cardinal, also here at Cheryl Graves, the firm of Lewis and Brisbois. They prepared an amicus brief on behalf of the International Municipal Lawyers Association. The factual background, as far as the material facts in this case, are very clear and they are undisputed. Basically, Cardinal got a call, dispatch, shots fired, someone has been shot at an apartment complex in North Las Vegas, and he has to respond. He makes several critical decisions as to how to respond. He has to choose the route he's going to take, first of all. Here, from the command he was at, he was north on 5th and west on Cheyenne. He chose this route because it was late at night in a pretty industrial area, so it can be low traffic. Also, there's fewer stoplights on that route, so he can get there quickly. That's why he chose this route, to get there as quickly and safely as possible. Turning left on 5th, he has to go through a red light. He has to choose whether to go through the red light and how to proceed through it. That's when the accident occurs. These facts match up with the elements necessary for discretionary immunity as set forth in Martinez versus Merit Center, which adopted the federal test in the Berkovitz-Galbert. The immunity changed with that case in 2007 as far as how we apply it. In order for immunity to apply to a state actor under NRS 41.032, all you need is two elements. First, that the action be taken in furtherance of a public policy. And second, that the actor make a conscious decision with respect to the action. They also clarified this can apply to everyday routine decisions, not just high-level decisions by a legislature, for example. And addressing Judge Tao's comment regarding whether it should apply to police activities, the Bachelor Supreme Court has applied this in police actions in, I believe, Siebert versus City of Reno, which was unpublished, but was regarding police activities and covering a crime scene. Here it's undisputed that these elements are met. It's undisputed that Cargallo was responding to an emergency. Here, shots fired, the person had been shot. The public policies at stake are several. Enforce the law, protect the public, capture criminals. It's not a gray area when you're talking about police work. It's also undisputed that Cargallo made conscious decisions as to how to go about his response to this particular emergency. He decided what route to take and how to proceed through the red light of Cheyenne. This was not a case of asleep at the wheel, as mentioned in...
How do you distinguish between this and the Butler case? I mean, there, in the Butler case, right, the one that we were talking about, Butler versus Bear, where they brought the suit against MSP, I mean, they clearly remanded it back for a jury to determine whether or not respondents' actions constituted negligence.
Well, here
in the way he deposited, and they called it depositing the inmate.
This is very different because it's very specific to this particular kind of emergency, proceeding through a red light in response to an emergency.
Well, how about my question about parsing through each cause of action? Tell me where, between the written findings and the oral argument and his oral decision, did the district court parse out the conduct here for each, whether or not discretionary immunity or immunity even applies?
Well, we had argued that, if there cannot be a cause of action for negligence against our officer, the rest of the claims fail as a matter of law. And that was something that was included in our motion for summary judgment and again in the motion for reconsideration.
So there are two parts of negligence here. They're saying, and looking at the complaint, it says failure to use lights and siren, and the other part was failure to use due care. There was two parts to that negligence cause of action.
Yes, and both of those parts are included in NRS
8.7. All right, so you're saying that both of them are covered by immunity.
Yes, Judge. And the mistake that I think appellant is making is...
Well, how do you even, with the test, the two-prong test, from the United States Supreme Court. How is this a policy decision when he's going to the different places? I mean, if that were the case, taken to its logical extreme, everything the police ever does is never negligent because it's always a matter of choice.
That's an argument they make below, and it's not where we're going. We never argued that. We're not
saying
that a police officer has shown up and he's on duty, he's in furtherance of a public policy. And that's not out of compromise. That's because that's what the case law says. The cases that we cited out of Virginia, out of Texas, out of Minnesota, talking about it. Look,
and not Ninth Circuit or Nevada.
Well, we don't have any case law in Nevada, and so we do have to look elsewhere for cases that are directly factually on point. And what we provided was a number of cases. Basala versus Kacheski out of Minnesota. Colby versus Boyd out of, Virginia. Terrell versus Larson out of Minnesota. Mews versus Schleiden out of Virginia. And then Rivers versus City of Houston out of Texas. All of these jurisdictions have their own red light statute. They're equivalent of 44B.700. I can read the statutes here if you would like.
No,
but
okay.
No one had a problem. None of these jurisdictions had a problem with granting immunity for this very specific situation because of the high stress.
So tell me, out of the jurisdictions you just quoted, what jurisdiction had a statute that mirrored our jurisdiction that we can look to?
All of them, Judge. Minnesota is section 169.03 regarding emergency vehicles.
I looked at the Minnesota one. The Minnesota one looks at is identical to our Nevada statute, and in the Thompson case, that is not what it says. Okay, keep going. I'll find it. Thompson versus the Minnesota.
So let's take it. Let's take it out of the emergency context for a second. Let's say a police car is driving by and he's not responding directly to a call. He's driving to, driving back to the station, into his ship, and he rear-ends a guy. Can you or not?
No.
Why not? What's the difference? What's the legal principle that separates one from the other?
Because there's no decision. That's the difference, I think.
If I'm 5 miles from the station, I could decide five different ways to go back to the station. Why is that? What's the legal principle? There's a decision there. What's the legal principle that differentiates the decision how you respond to a call versus the decision how you drive to go get a donor to go back to the station?
That's the rationale of the cases that we just referred to regarding all these jurisdictions with their own red light statute, talking about the reason that they're immune is because this job is hard enough as it is. They have to make split-second decisions, and we don't want them second-guessing themselves and delaying their reaction to these emergency situations. You always try to find a real-life example to sort of pin this to. and I didn't want to go there because it would seem overly dramatic. 6 months ago, if I had said, we have to be able to get there as quickly as possible, because what if somebody starts firing a machine gun out of the 32nd floor at Mandalay Bay into a crowd of 20,000 people? People would say I was being overly dramatic. Then October 1 happened. This is the world we live in, where hyperbole no longer exists. Our officers need to be able to get to these emergency situations as quickly as possible, and I don't want them to hesitate because they're concerned they might be held civilly liable if something goes wrong on the way there. Seconds count.
Mr. Kraft, do you think there's any analogy to the pursuit situation? Officers can pursue somebody, can put red lights and siren on, they can go through lights, yet it seems like policies have changed, and now those pursuits are being cut off because it's so dangerous. Is that much different here of going through a light with allegedly no siren on and not having a good view?
Well, pursuit is going to be something that's going to be subject to the internal policies of the police department. I understand the arguments that he's making, that like, well, she didn't hear the lights and he says he had, or she didn't hear the sirens, but he says he had the sirens on. Their own expert points out that those are not mutually exclusive. Sam Terry said that even if he had his sirens on, she probably wouldn't have heard it. So I'm not sure there's even an issue of fact there.
Well, the pursuit case is exactly what City of Minnesota is, Thompson versus City of Minnesota, and it ruled exactly the opposite of what you're saying. And their statute is exactly like ours. And it had to do with the pursuit.
Well, we're not talking about pursuit here. What we're talking about is going through a red light.
Well, they went through a red light during the pursuit. Exactly what you just said.
Well, the Minnesota cases they're talking about that I have cited found them on behalf of the officers and found them in liability.
Tell me what case it is that you're citing to, because I have a 2006 Thompson versus City of
Minnesota. It was Vasallo versus Majeski. That's 842 Northwest 2nd, 456. That was 2014. And also out of Minnesota, out of 2008, was Terrell versus Larson. I believe that was unpublished, but it's 2008.
It's unpublished?
I believe so.
Okay.
2008 Westlaw 2168348. Again, a police officer was immune from liability for an accident for proceeding through a red light while responding to an emergency. Now, getting back to NRS 44-700, another mistake that I believe the appellant's making here is overextending what the application of that would be if he was found to have violated that, whether it was by having the sirens off or failing to use due care, both of which are required. Because even if they were able to prove that, at most what they have is a claim for negligence per se. Now, that, even that would not rise to the level of the exceptions that have been pointed out for discretionary immunity. And those were actually clarified in Franchise Tax Court versus Hyatt, which was not 2014. Well, it was then, but then it came back around, with the most recent version being December 26, 2017. It was stated confirmed that, yes, the standards set forth in Fallout, the only exceptions to this being either intentional torts or bad faith conduct. Those are what it takes to get around discretionary immunity, not mere negligence. So even if there was a violation of NRS 44-700, it would not suffice for plaintiff or appellant to get around discretionary immunity. Bad faith conduct was described as bad faith conduct, which would be acts which are completely outside the scope of what our actor is supposed to be doing. The language here was that bad faith involves an implemented attitude that completely transcends the circumference of authority granted to the actor. That is absolutely not what happened here. Our officer, our sergeant, was responding to an emergency, rushing into danger. This is what he swore he would do when he became a police officer. This is good faith conduct. As far as intentional torts, none were alleged here. So even if they're right about everything they're saying about NRS 44-700, all they would have is negligence claim, and they would not have an exception to discretionary immunity. And getting back to the other cases about going through a red light, not only is appellant completely failed to come up with any case where the opposite happened, where an officer was found liable for going through a red light while responding to an emergency, they don't even discuss our case. They don't even mention that until the reply brief. And then all they have to say is that there was a violation of NRS 44-700. But there is no case offered by appellant where an officer went through a red light and he was found liable. He was not found guilty. There are no competing cases brought up by the appellant. And as far as the reconsideration, I believe what appellant is missing here, they say, well, there's no new facts. Like, well, reconsideration is appropriate where the court has misapplied the law. And what happened here was the court misread NRS 41.032. What he said at the close of the summary judgment hearing, the first go-around, actually the second go-around, was that he wanted the jury to be able to look at our officer's conduct and decide whether or not he made a good call. So I asked myself, I was like, well, what are you really asking the jury to think about? And And what he's asking them to do is to figure out whether or not he abused his discretion in responding to his accident, which is precisely included in the language of what we're immune from under NRS 41.032. So we went back to the court and we explained that and also the limits of discretion, because he said it can't be unfettered. And he's right. There are limitations, but those limitations are intentional torts or bad faith conduct, neither of which were present.
What about, do you think it was proper for the district court to be talking about the plaintiff when she had been cited on her end of it and pled no contest? Because there seemed to be quite a back and forth, and it seemed like he considered what that citation.
Well, he did say that.
What was that about?
Remember, the motions in limine were going to be heard the same day that was set for the motion.
But the court brought it up in terms of an immunity argument on a reconsideration motion.
Well, he's not sitting there in a vacuum. He did say what he said, but that didn't make it into the order. The order that we wrote said, like, basically, this is it.
Would you concede, though, that that has nothing to do with immunity and the analysis that the district court should have been looking at?
Well, I agree, Judge, but I don't think that made it into the order that made it into what his official finding was. Now, Helen had their chance to submit their own order. If they thought that was important, they thought that was key to what the judge was deciding, they could have submitted their own order and said that. They said, like, wait, you're making a decision based on this, that was improper. Include that in our version of the order, approve that. They never submitted one. All we have is the order that we submitted.
So you intentionally left it out?
That wasn't what we were arguing. We didn't include that as part of what we were saying. It was a whole separate motion that was never ruled upon because the reconsideration is heard first. Judge, I think that the court ruled properly. I think they applied Martinez versus Marisak correctly. I think the material facts here are clear.
You're not going to expand on the plum I gave you on Payo, the new case that came down at all?
Well, that is correct. That we do have discretion as far as our hiring, but the argument that we made below...
This is a de novo review. So are you familiar with that case?
I have read it, and we should be immune for our decisions to hire, retain Sergeant Carvalho. There's really nothing, no substance to the claim when we argue below, basically, that, look, if you don't have a claim for negligence, you don't have a claim for negligent hiring. You basically kicked the legs off of the chair. And on that basis, the court granted that our motion with respect to those claims as well. And I believe it was correct in doing so. If you have any further questions, I'm at your disposal, obviously.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kraft would like you to believe that it's just the cost of doing business as a police officer when people don't follow basic safety rules on our road and other people get hurt. And it's okay because they have a justification for it just because they wear a badge. And certainly by giving them that unfettered discretion to do that would certainly bloat the interpretation of what constitutes policy as is required by the Martinez Court. Specifically, they said in their answering brief, of course there are risks, but weighing those risks against the certainty of a crime having already been committed, those risks are acceptable. That's what they said. And the amicus is even more disturbing when it said that accidents happen like this one is part of the reason why Nevada requires its drivers to carry automobile insurance and why mortgage companies require homeowners to carry homeowners insurance. This statement is patently untrue. And in addition, it doesn't take into account that people can be injured when people don't follow their own policies and procedures in trying to further their goal of trying to protect the community. In doing so, Officer Cargill, when he went through that intersection, did not benefit his own policy. He was supposed to get to an exigent circumstance where apparently somebody was with the... Was that already 3 minutes?
That's your time. No, let you finish your sentence.
Well, I thought I had 3 minutes. That's only been a minute.
I think it was three. It seems like a minute because it's such a good time for you to be up here.
I started a timer on my watch right before I walked out.
That was probably the end of mine.
You know what? It was.
Was it?
Whoops.
We'll give you
How about 2 minutes?
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sorry about that.
That's okay, Your Honor. I appreciate that. I do want to tell you that your ruling today would have wide ramifications. Not every single police officer out there would now have unfettered discretion to be able to do anything they want, whenever they want. Because really, there is no limitations on it, other than what he's saying is carved out by the Phelan case with regards to intentional conduct. But that's not true. But even beyond that, you now have county social workers who are taking care of foster kids. You have
third-party contractors who are building bridges and roads for us. A decision that would uphold this particular judge's ruling, the way it was interpreted, would actually allow for those individuals to have discretionary immunity in that wide range as well. Your Honor pointed out a factor that I didn't catch what you were saying about that new case, and I apologize. I didn't know the case, and that's a failure on my part. But I can tell you that you make a good point. There's nothing in this judge's order that even addresses that issue. He doesn't even talk about it.
Well, the case just came down.
I'm sorry?
The case just came down last month.
Very true, but he doesn't even address that particular element or claim. In other words, he's dismissing the entire case based upon the one minor argument that they were talking about. Everything else fell down from there. So the point is, his order needed to have a findings of fact and conclusions along with regards to each of the elements before he dismisses an entire case. Let alone, he also failed to put any basis whatsoever. If you look at his order, there's nothing in there about why he reconsidered it. And certainly, as your honors are well aware, there has to be a clearly erroneous finding by this district court judge before he can overrule himself just 36 days later. 36 days later,
here's the problem that you're running into. Whether or not he followed the technical requirements for reconsideration, sovereign immunity is a subject matter problem, and subject matter challenges are never waived and can actually be raised for the first time on appeal, even sua sponte by the court, because it goes to the power of the court. So it may be true that in other contexts, technical compliance with reconsideration matters, but not when there's a question of subject matter jurisdiction. Agree or disagree?
I would have to agree, Your Honor. I understand what you're saying, obviously. My point was just that he didn't take any consideration. Right. We're not even looking at that.
I mean, it's a separate flaw, but, you know, but anyway. All right.
We out of time, I guess?
Yeah, I think we are.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. All right, this matter will stand submitted. We appreciate it.